I'm just testing the tape here before going to interview Molly Ingram on the 3rd of February, 1983, in Victoria, British Columbia. Testing the tape. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. No, that's actually going round. Yes, that's going round, so that's all right.
Eat. Those are hot. Shall I have them before they get cold?
Thanks. I thought maybe what we could do is... Thank you. Is start with your story when you go out to Singapore from London. You've been working in London.
Mm-hmm.
And
That's not in my path.
No, it doesn't matter, but just maybe you could start there, and then when you get to Singapore, you do join MI5.
Mm-hmm, yes.
And you could talk
about that. I've got a whole lot about that. I could get that out of my thing. Mm. I've got a fantastic amount of that.
About what?
Singapore and MI5.
You do? Mm-hmm. Well, what kind of stuff do you have?
Well, the things that I was doing now. MI5, we were the... Oh, well. I start off again like that. We were organizing. Now, I think we were the central body between all the free services and the civil authorities. And we worked in police headquarters. And everything that was any importance from the intelligence point of view from the services came through me, and from the police and the civil authorities also came through me. So I made fantastic card index thing there. Mostly out of my own hands. I mean, I made it myself there. And it must have been considered good because later on, a whole lot of new intelligence groups started. They proliferated almost like this. And they all came and said, could they see how it worked? Because every person was under, first of all, their own name, any alias. They had a new card under that. And then they would also be carded under what they were supposed to be a suspect for. If it was bottles, if it was money, if it was playing with either Germans or Japanese or something. They were on the Japanese card. This would all be in so-and-so, see so-and-so, you see?
Yeah.
And I had access to the police files. And I used to be awfully thrilled, actually, when police officers would turn up and say, could I look at your cards? Because I want to find something in our files and I can't find it. And so from our cards, they could find it immediately. I was very proud about that.
How did you get into MI5 in the first place in Singapore?
Well, I went out there with my mother because she was sick and I had 6 months leave from the Church of England Pensions Board. No pay. But my boss at that moment, my little minor boss, was beginning to discover that his wife didn't understand him, and I didn't want to be involved. So I thought if I could get away, it's a good thing. I'd been offered a job in Singapore, and we arrived there about 3 days before Christmas in 1938. And the people who came to the thing that I knew, who said they'd got this wonderful job for me, it was much more pay than one got at home, came to the boat and met us there. Of course, the man's died and there isn't a job. I'm told that there really wasn't one anyway. They made it up. Why? I can't think. But anyway, there we were, with very little money and nothing sort of going. And also, they disappeared, so I hadn't got anybody who'd ever heard of me or knew anything about me at all. But the Bishop of Lahore in India was a great friend of the family. Actually, he married my mother. I mean, you know, he didn't marry her for himself. He married her to my stepfather. And I mean, we'd known them for a long time like that. And so she wrote to them and said,
also,
in touch with the the Singapore bishop, and we used to go to things there. And then, I mean, so that they'd realize that we were fairly respectable and fairly like that. Well, then somehow or another, all three services wanted me, but they couldn't get the money to pay for me. Not that I was wanting very much, but the grants, they had to wait until they came through. And there was the Air Force wanting me, and the Army, and also Navy, should start off them to begin with. Quite as lucid as it should be. Okay.
Yeah.
That's lovely.
So, yes, we're on.
Are we on?
Recording.
Oh, I'm sorry. So, I was offered a job by MI5, the Defence Security Officer in Singapore, who was the... we did... This is where I'd like to start again, because I'm stupid. I'm sorry.
Don't worry about it.
Which was combining all three services with the civil authorities, and everything in the way of intelligence came through me from the services or from the civil authorities, so that we really had a very good idea of what was happening and all the personalities involved.
What was your actual position?
I was personal assistant.
You was personal assistant to the head of
to
MI5
the no to the Defence Security Officer, who was right. The MI5 representative there.
What was the size of the Secretary of Staff?
Well, later on, first of all, when I started, there were two of us, and then I had four girls, and we had six Chinese clerks who were doing all, because we had records of all the Chinese who were employed in by various contractors and things in the dockyard or doing any military installations or anything like that. And because they were written in Chinese in the characters, they could find out that that really was that person. Otherwise, a Chong could be a Chung or a Tsung or a Chung or, you know, almost anything.
You didn't read Chinese.
No, I didn't read Chinese, but they did there, and we had them of a various, I mean, there was a Shanghainese one, and there was a Cantonese, and there were, you know, they did all the sort of whole gamut of it.
What was the main concern in Singapore? Was it naval defenses and the Japanese?
The Japanese was one of the things, but yeah. To begin with, Singapore was a completely, had a completely polyglot community. There were mixtures of everything. And so there were Germans there, and there were German Japs and German sort of maybe Javanese or something like that. And any of them were potentially dangerous because they could get in touch with the people who were around there. The Japs stayed in for quite a long time. And actually, we had quite an amusing thing. Later on, we weren't allowed, before the war started with the Japanese, we gathered that in the Jap Consul General office that there was a transmitter, and they could transmit out all information about boats going up and down, and so disastrous for our shipping because they'd held the Germans, and the Germans then sank them. But we weren't allowed to do anything because we didn't want to bring the Japs in. At the moment, the Western desert was starting, and that was to be the main sphere of stuff, and we weren't to involve anybody else in it. But eventually they said we could, and I think they made a rather good plan for it. To begin with, the Jap Consul General and his wife were invited to dinner by the I can't think what his name is at the moment now, but I'll tell you, he was the number two man in the government there, very important, and various other people asked this dinner, including my mother and me. And that afternoon, the Inspector General of Police came in to me and said, now, for heaven's sake, don't let them go or anything until after 10:15, because if it's up to them, we'll have got our stuff done. But if they go before that, it'll be disastrous. But anything after that will be considered as a bonus. Well, we went to dinner there at 8 o'clock, the usual time. And just after he'd left his office, the wires, the telephone wires, were cut so that all were put out of order anyway. And a little policeman, a mata-mata, dressed as a burglar or as a sort of something quite different, very much disguised, he went into the, was seen going into the consulate grounds, and another policeman who was a legitimate policeman saw him, and attempting to be helpful, he sent for reinforcements. because they wanted to help the Japanese, because they wouldn't be allowed to go in, otherwise they'd claim immunity from anything like that, diplomatic immunity. Anyway, he got in eventually, and with all the rest of the police that came, and they found the transmitter, and one of them very carefully broke it, which he was reprimanded fantastically about it. They took out vital parts, I don't know which parts they were, but afterwards he was given a bonus. Anyway, all this time the consular staff couldn't get hold of the consul general because the telephone wires were supposed to be broken. Anyway, we had dinner there and we played some silly game afterwards. And you know, the thing that you play games with matches or something, and if you lose them you're supposed to stop or be out of it. And I try to do a complete village idiot thing and say, oh, but I must have another chance because after all I'd only just started. Anyway, we kept them going until about 10:45. So I thought that was marvellous. And they left. And as I was going past the colonial secretary, that's it, he squeezed my hand and winked, so I didn't realise that he knew that I was in on the thing. But I thought that was quite amusing. Anyway, just soon after this, the Jap War started. Incidentally, before this, I don't think I told you, why we were worried about the Jap Consul General was that they suddenly got 25 cooks. And the cooks had been seen in naval uniform beforehand and being specialists in harbour installations and etc., etc. Not the sort of people who really were cooks, but they were on their cards as that. And so it was quite a good thing to get in and do that, which we did.
That's very interesting. That's a good story.
I thought that was a good story. Mm-hmm.
Were you concerned about, let's say, communists in
Singapore? Not very much, no. Not at that time. It's all...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I'm crackling.
That's all right. Crackle away.
Well, no, we weren't very interested in the communists. Because... very interested in communists, but we did have a tremendous lot of Germans who were there, and directly they came into the war, and Austrians, and well, there were quite a lot of Jews, German Jews, and of course we were very sorry for them, but they thought that it was safer from the Singapore point of view to transfer them to Australia. And actually the Queen Mary came down and was being used before it was used as a troop carrying thing. They took them all off. And can I tell you a slightly funny story about this? Because my boss, who is an ex-marine colonel, British, was a little clueless about some things. And he rushed up to me when they were seeing these people off, and he said, oh, will you get a letter down to the superintendent of the detective branch? Because file something another can't go because she's about to become pregnant. And what he really meant was that she was having a baby within a fortnight or something, and they thought that it'd be quite possible for her to go down under not a very large guard under those circumstances. But I wondered, as it was, we were going through rather miserable time of the war, whether it'd be worthwhile to put it in, but I didn't. I was correct. But I still think it was rather sweet. And he just had a baby, so he should have known.
I would hope so.
But he was a bit clueless about those things.
Is it generally indicative of the level of intelligence of the...
No, I think they're really terribly so. But he wasn't about those things. And his... I don't know, I found him rather difficult to cope with sometimes because he always wanted to have a meeting round a table. But all the people used to ring me up and ask for information and things because they knew they'd get it from me, whereas it didn't sort of transpire so much with him.
You think he wasn't very used to working with women?
No, I don't think it was that. I think he was a very charming person, actually, and very and good-looking and things, but he just was a little clueless, I think. I'm sorry, I'm being unkind. I shouldn't have said that. Anyway, we had a whole lot of quite interesting things that happened. We were supposed to check anybody who was taken on by the services, whether they were any good or not. and cards were made for them under all the bits and pieces there to find out. And we, I think there were about 10 of them, very super code and cipher people were sent out from England, men. And they'd all been checked up at home, so we didn't have to check them up because they'd just arrived there and they were at the naval, it was the dockyard's special radio thing that were getting all their signals and that kind of thing, at a place called Cranges. Well, we weren't supposed to check those because they'd already been checked. Well, I got a telephone call one morning from the OC there, who was the lieutenant commander, and he said there was one man who I shall call Mr. Smith, had been in the hospital with DTs, and they wanted him to be picked up because it wasn't a good idea, and he was seen wandering vaguely in the direction of Lavender Street. Well, Lavender Street is the red light district, and full of Jap houses and anything else that was there. I mean, any information that came out would have been very vital and certainly shouldn't go through those channels. Anyway, would I please have him arrested? And I said, on what grounds? Because I knew there were civilians. And he said, I want him for being absent without leave. And I said, well, you can't. Not a civilian. You could have him perhaps under Defense of the Realm Act or something like that, but not as it just wouldn't do. So he said, well, I want him arrested as being absent without leave. I was a little upset because, I mean, I did know my stuff. Anyway, I sent down a note to the superintendent of the detective branch, please pick up him. He was seen wandering vaguely in that direction and bring him back. Well, I was working like this, and lunchtime I had a sandwich there and was sort of trying to catch up some of the time that one wastes on all the funny telephone calls one had. Call from Cranjay saying, oh, Miss Ingram, have you done anything about that yet? I said, oh, yes, I had ordered him to be arrested within 10 minutes of your call. Oh, well, you think you could get it rescinded because, you see, he can't be arrested for being absent on leave. I didn't say I told you so, but I said I'll see what I can do. At that moment, our doors in the office were rather like a stable, you know, sort of half doors in the middle like this, if you get air on either side. And on over the top, there was a very large English policeman, sergeant, sort of peering in. So I finished my telephone call and went up to him. And he said, I've got the prisoner outside and he's in an ugly mood. So I thought, oh my God, what am I to do? The only thing to do is to try and do a village idiot act. So I powdered my nose because I thought that would give me encouragement. And I went out and said, oh, Mr. Smith, we've been so worried about you. We thought you'd had a return of your fever. You know, you get so many fevers out here. There's dengue and there's sandfly fever. And we were afraid that might happen. And, oh, now, how are you? Are you taking a tonic? And now, would you like some Bavro? We've got some here. It's very strengthening. And went on like this sort of rather absurdly. But anyway, he beamed. And we parted quite great friends. And I arranged for a car to take him home, a staff car, with no deviations en route to where he was staying. Well, that was that. Any time afterwards I saw him, he used to wave at me as if I was the greatest of friends, which a little amused me. Anyway, I went back to work and sort of didn't think much about it until that night I happened to be dining with a... Do you mind me ad-libbing like this?
No.
I happened to be dining with a Captain Mulock, who had been a dugout. He was a naval captain, and he was the only person I've ever met with a polar medal. A completely white polar medal. I don't know which particular thing he'd been on, but he had been on, and he was rather a marvelous man, and I think he was doing extended defenses or something. He'd been brought out to do that. Anyway, he used to have dinner parties quite often, and I rather think that our admiral, Sir Geoffrey Layton, had been what you call the first things when they start, a midshipman, on his ship, because he was nearly always there at the dinners, which was rather fun. I was asked quite often, which I also liked very much. And he used to say, now, what will you drink, my boy? Sir. And then, will you sit here, my boy? Sir. Which was a little amusing like that. anyway, at dinner this night, I was put next to the admiral, which, of course, was quite incorrect, because being a female, I had no official status at all, and there was a few naval wives there who were looking a little askance, but I was quite pleased because I'd met the admiral before, and he was fun, and, you know. So in the middle of dinner, he suddenly turned round to me and said, I saw you had some trouble at the office this afternoon. So I didn't want to get anybody into trouble, so I sort of said, trouble? And then he came out, so I thought, well, it's no good. I'll tell him what it's all about, told him all about Mr. Smith. And he was really very amused, and he said, I think you've saved the government several hundreds of thousands of dollars because he might have claimed wrongful arrest. So, anyway, that was that. And I thought that was quite an amusing little episode that had happened.
And there was nothing, I mean, there was nothing wrong with Mr. Smith at all. I mean, presumably he'd been seen wandering in this area and there was nothing suspicious about nothing.
Well, having had DTs and going there, I don't know that he'd been as checked as well as... I don't think from a security point of view it was a good idea. So,
did he repeat the offence?
We didn't hear about it, so I don't think so. But anyway, I got off from the policeman saying that he was in a nasty mood. I think quite often it's a good thing to do a village interdict. It seems to work quite well there on those occasions like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was just one of the many things there. And then, of course, we had a frightful time when we were attacked. I remember our very first air raid. No, the first air raid was the night after Pearl Harbor. And we were in a house. We'd been lent a house then, which was rather fun. And I think principally because there was a dog that had recently been taken over by the owner, who was an old and very wealthy, I gather, solicitor, who'd gone over to Australia on holiday for 6 months and would we look after his house. And the dog, which was an Airedale called Peter. And Peter was an absolute darling, and Peter loved me very much, which was made it rather nice for us. We were living in a hotel, and though it was going to cost much more than being in a hotel, we thought it was fun to go into a house. So we were there, and the first month, war hadn't happened as far as we were concerned. And then that night, I think about 120 bombers came over. We knew it couldn't be ours, because we hadn't got as much. I mean, nothing like as much. And it was, I remember, it was a lovely night with dappled clouds and the moon sort of shining through like this when they came over. They did a little bit in Singapore, nothing very much, and I don't think anybody was killed, or if they were, it wasn't anything very much like that. But it was a bit nerve-wracking and right away from anybody else, because the house was a little bit secluded. Anyway, the next morning, the main store there was called Robinson's. It was a sort of general place that people went, and they just opened a new dining room that was air-conditioned, which in Singapore is absolutely marvellous, because your face drips otherwise. Anyway, there was a notice, do try our air-conditioned lunch, have lunch there. It's more air-conditioned than we expected, or than we'd hoped, and there were these huge holes sort of in the roof, but that was about all that really had been affected. We didn't really have very much then for a few week or so, I think, before they were, because they were collecting all up in the north bit there, Kirtibakuru, and of course then about the next night, I think we heard about the Prince of Wales and the Repulse going down, which was ghastly. But thank heavens, about, I think, 2,000 of them were rescued by American destroyers that were in the... I've got their names, but I can't remember them offhand. Do you mind? I can look it up and tell you if you like. Anyway, that started. And I remember the first really bad one we had a telephone call that they were expecting, again, about 120 bombers were coming over towards us. It was in the afternoon, and we were in the office. And I went into my boss and said, look, this is coming. I think everybody should take cover. He said, we've been told we should be ready for it. And so, would you like me to fill that up? We can turn me off from
there. No, that's fine.
Would you like that, huh? And so he said, oh, yes, everything must be shut up. And he ran downstairs. Well, I went into my girls and said, they better go. And I got hold of we'd got two nice lads who used to take letters and things, peons, and got them to go down and to tell the Chinese clerks that they could all go down. And then I was left. And I found that he had a pile about that high, 27 inches high, I suppose, of various files on his desk. The only safe that we had was left open, and so I had to lock that. Then these, I'd been crying, I'd been asking for a new filing cabinet for quite a long time, which we needed, so that I could have put these all in the dollop, instead of which, as we only had about that much space in any of them, I had to put them back in the right place, otherwise they'd have been lost. And I suppose it took about 10 minutes or so. Anyway, by the time I went downstairs, this sounds as if I was rather stupid, but it was my first real bad air raid, expecting it to be terrible. My knees were shaking and I held on to the banisters because I didn't want anybody to know that I was the only person left up on that area at all there. And afterwards I made a very strong thing that directly we had an air raid, that all files were to be put away and everyone could keep one on their desk that they could work on, and they must be responsible to put it away. So there we are. But was nerve-wracking, a bit.
How long have these bombing raids gone?
Well, until I left, and I left on the 7th of February. It fell on the 15th. And we had been an island for quite a long time by then. The causeway was all blown up. Incidentally, when it happened, this is funny, this isn't anything to do with the war. Would you? I have a passion for Jane Austen, and I adore Pride and Prejudice. And the Americans had just made a film with Olivier and Greer Garson, and, you know, it was going to be simply marvelous. And it arrived in Singapore, and we'd been busy, sort of. Well, I mean, we'd been working like that, and at night we went off to a canteen in, it was supposed to be the secret headquarters of all the people that had come down there from other places. And my mother and I decided we would go to this film, so we went. And people were supposed to sit upstairs in the balcony, unless you were the hoi polloi who sat down below. So we sat up in this rather old-fashioned thing. And they started going up the causeway. And you heard these frightful bangs. And then there were they would come across with the odd bomb that would be thrown somewhere near this. Plaster fell off the ceiling like this. Practically everybody left, but we sat until the end, which was crazy, but it was rather, we enjoyed it. So there we are. Well, it seemed to be a good idea then.
And we enjoyed the movie terrifically.
So, and I've seen it, I don't know how many times since, but I've always remembered or thought that it was the most inappropriate place to hear Jane Austen.
Were you busy burning files, or did you take them with you?
No. Well, now, the files, we had them all arranged. We had a place that all our own paper. Oh, this is quite interesting, I think you'd like. All our own papers that we used, anything that you used in the daytime, you took a note on, or your carbon papers, or anything like that, were burnt every night before you left. There was a big thing on the roof, and I used to go up there. I or one of my girls would go and watch them burn it all. And to begin with, I used to think this was rather stupid. But after I'd been there for a few weeks, the Inspector General of Police came along to me and said, I wonder if you could help us, because you do speak Italian. And I said, well, not really. I can sing the odd Italian love song, and I don't really know any. Much. And he said, well, we've just got some scraps that we've collected out of the Italian Consul General's waste paper basket, and it's his report, we think, on his idea of the defense of Singapore, what he thinks has been done, and it'd be terribly interesting to get it done. So they gave me a glossary of terms, military terms, because I mean, I had not a clue about that, and I had these things that had just been torn up and thrown into the waste paper basket. And the difficulty was to discover whether it was written on this side of the paper or that side. And as you had to have a fan, because it was too terribly hot, I had a bit of talc like this over and then tried to do them underneath and tried to get it to come into some sense. Anyway, after quite a long time, I pieced it together. And they said it was a terribly interesting report, and they were very pleased with it. But that is not a thing that ordinary people do.
So that was a standard routine kind of security practice.
It was a security practice. After that, I didn't mind burning my stuff in the waste paper basket. But to begin with, I thought that was rather unnecessary, a little bit. But, I mean, very important from that point of view, wasn't it?
Obviously very important, and that's how lots of
stuff comes out.
Of
I know. So I thought that was quite interesting there. Another thing, rather in the same line, only this time, it was when the war really had been declared, the chief censor sent us a most beautiful, it looked like a botanical drawing, of bramble, the leaves, you know, all beautifully done like this, and little bits of obviously blackberries or something. And if you put it onto a map of Indonesia, all the squiggles were the bays there, and those were all the gun emplacements that they had, which was quite fun.
And that was a map or a drawing produced by whom?
By somebody, I should imagine probably a German, because there were a whole lot of Germans in Dutch East Indies. And that made it quite difficult when they were on, and, you know, we weren't, our war hadn't started then, so, except that we had to be careful. Well, but I thought that was interesting. It was beautifully done.
Interesting way of producing information.
Yes, it was. Because normally one wouldn't have thought of being anything until you tried it on top of this. One always had to try various things. And then there were various letters from people. And
were you involved in censorship of mail?
Not me personally. But I used to get some of these odd things and it would be sent to me and say, I wonder if you could, can you find anything out of this? And, one of the things I remember, somebody had written in shorthand, tried to write love poems. And their shorthand was terribly bad. They always made an N hook when they meant it a V one. And it was written extraordinarily badly. And it was sort of, you know, I love you when skies above and you I love and that sort of thing. But there was a little pattern in it eventually that one found.
So there was, this was a code of some kind?
It was a code of some sort, I suppose. But it was interesting to find them there, I think. Well, then, can we leave Singapore now, or do you want me to go on?
Just tell me what happened to your files. Did you manage to get them away?
No, I couldn't possibly.
Or did you in the end burn them?
Well, no, we had them already there. That if anything came in, that must be burned. That must be burned. That must, and the last thing, if the worst came to worst, you must eat it. You can't possibly leave it. And you see, most of the files, by that time, they were telling you all about people who were suspect up island, or people who'd be picked up, or that sort of thing. And it wouldn't really have terribly mattered, I don't think. Things like recycling tables and things, those were frightfully important.
So what did you do with
them? Well, those were all supposed to be burnt, you see. But I left before the office was still going on.
Oh, I see. You left before that.
I left on the 7th. And then on the 6th, I had gone in to my boss because I had been the last woman left in police headquarters. We had a whole lot of them before, the new one that we'd gone into. And everybody had left, and I'd been about there for about a fortnight, I think, by myself. And I went in and saw him in between one of the bombing things and said, look, would you like to ensure that Fort Channing, that was the headquarters there, the general headquarters, the thing, that if there's going to be any general evacuations, my mother and I are here, she refused to go without me, and that we would then want to be left behind. So he said, oh, Miss Ingram, now, you know, I've been thinking of pushing on to Australia, where his wife was with a child, because there's not enough here for a man of my active mind to cope with now. I was a bit dumbfounded at this and went back into my office, and at that moment the Inspector General of Police came in, and he said, good God, why haven't you gone? So I said, well, I've just heard this. And he said, well, go immediately. You're not to stay on at all. Incidentally, I discovered that I was on a Jap blacklist, which was not a very pleasant thing, because much as, now this sounds absurd in this kind of life, but there, one had to think, if one was captured, could you possibly get yourself sensitized to the extent that you wouldn't give people away? I mean, somehow try and organize your mind that something had to be done like that. Well, I was going to try if I could. I mean, I'm not brave, but I thought I'd attempt to do what one can there. And then, of course, with my mother with me, if they'd done anything to her, I should have told them everything. I wouldn't have. And I didn't think I could do the village idiot thing very much under those circumstances. So it seemed to me the only thing to do, and this I say now, it seems absurd, but then it seemed to be quite normal. I arranged for a man in the police headquarters that if the Japs really did come, I was to be shot. I arranged for people in the hotel we were staying in that both my mother and I would be shot. So that, I mean, that we would be, well, I couldn't do any harm then. Seemed to me much the most sensible thing to do. But I can't imagine ever really wanting to commit suicide myself now. I hadn't got anything I could do it with then, except perhaps a pen knife that one could have cut one's wrist or something, but it seemed to be much better to have a nice shot. And I'm so glad now that I didn't have a rendezvous with death. As, isn't it Alan Seeger who writes rather a lovely poem about it? I have a rendezvous with death when spring comes back with rustling shade and apple blossoms fill the air. I was quite glad I hadn't. Anyway, there we are. But I know it sounds silly now, but at the time it was a sensible thing to do. And it wasn't any worse than saying, look, my car's on the blink, could you give me a lift to the office? I mean, it was that sort of, wasn't peculiar. So.
Do you think a lot of people felt that way?
No, because I think a lot of people hadn't any information that would have been any use to anybody. I mean, really. Whereas we had a lot of vital stuff there that one had to. So much of it we tried to scrap beforehand that I left, well, the next day, this was, no, you don't want to hear any more about it, do you?
Finish the story.
Well, the next day, I got on to the P&O, and they said they had a boat going out, and the next day we were to go to somewhere way out in the sort of district there like that, to a house. Nothing like in town or anything like that, at 8 o'clock in the morning, and you get your things. Well, I kept our passports in the office because I thought it was safer to have them there in case we were bombed. And so I rang up the chief passport thing and said, look, could you put them up? If I come on my way home, could you please stay and make them up to date for us? And so that was all right. So I had those there. And the next morning I was up there with my driver early in the morning before 8. It was a huge queue of people. Anyway, I left him down below in the car, went up with my bits and pieces. My mother's name was Crawford, incidentally, which made it, so I had to go through two queues, which is a little complicated. Anyway, got up there, luckily, I don't say luckily, really, but there was an air raid, and practically everybody went off and took cover. Well, I thought, no, this is the way I get on in the queue, I won't be wasting so much time. So I was getting quite near, and I noticed somebody had a paper that I'd left behind the car, so I thought, well, hold my place for me, and I'll go down and get it. And as I got down this bit, there was rather a nice road that had quite nice shady trees over it, and at that side there was a deep ditch. Singapore was full of deep ditches like this, and up from the I could see a whole lot of Indian heads of an Indian regiment. I knew we'd had quite a lot there, and a British officer there, and he said, you better take cover. And I said, no, I've just got to get this thing here. So I got this, and at this moment a plane came down and started machine gunning there. So I don't know quite how, but Toki-san, that was my driver, and we were sort of pulled into what was a very nice clean drain. Luckily. Anyway, we stayed there until it was over, and I asked them to look after him and went back and got our things done. But it wasn't until about 12 o'clock that I'd arranged for us. This time we weren't going out in a P&O boat, we were going on a French maritime. Anyway, its name was the Teddy Crusoe. And it normally would hold something like 200 passengers, maybe 50 white. I'm not being beastly, but the rest, the dark ones were coolies. They weren't, I mean, they hadn't been used to any kind of civilization or anything like that. And if they were well, I mean, they would count as the whites and have cabins and that kind of thing. The other people had decks. We had over 2,000. And we went. And because we had our things given to us with P&O, we were on A deck, which should have been right up above. Maritime French things were right down, three decks below third class, which is coolies, yes. And you went down greasy iron ladders, and when you got to the bottom, there was a huge hold. Well, we had 150 people in it. And it was awash with bilge water. And you know those things they put in that are made of wood with holes in them like that you have in your bath, always that they have it at the side there so that you don't make the whole mess. They had those things going down, so you try to walk on that. there were a whole lot of tables along here, and your luggage had to be put up on the table because otherwise it'd be all soaked in things. And the other side, we ate. And, oh dear, it was frightful. The British ships, or, you know, any of our sort of ships like this, everything is terribly clean, and anything is painted most beautifully. Here we had what looked as if they were made of driftwood tables, big long ones like that, with large cracks in them. And up through the cracks would come cockroaches that high, who would sort of hope that you were leaving something for them. My mother and I usually managed to get a spoon between us, but you only had a knife down the end of the table, and there were sort of 10 on either side like that, or 12. So it was a little tricky. And, oh dear, it was revolting, really. Anyway, that went on. We arrived in Bombay on the, at least we were let off, I think, on the 4th of March, which was quite a long time, because it normally takes 5 days, giving you a day in Ceylon to go and...
Why did it take so long? From the 7th of February, the 7th or 8th of February until the 4th of March?
Yes, because we went zigzag backwards and forwards like that. We almost touched the African coast like that, because there were... The first two or three days... Oh, incidentally, the Exeter escorted us out, which was rather lovely. We had quite a lot of air raids the first few days, and then there was a mutiny. Because the British ship, the P&O ship that we were supposed to call, had a whole lot of terribly rough queue. I'm sorry, is it making light? Should I stop?
Well, I think we're going to have to turn the tape over.
I'm sorry, love.
It's all right. It's nothing's happened, but...